Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hello and welcome back to the EPL Roundtable. I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, and as always, if you'd like to reach us at the podcast, you can do so by either tweeting us at EPL Roundtable or emailing us at eplroundtable@gmail.com.
Hi, I'm Jamie Smith. I'm here to talk about Burnley.
Hi, I'm Gita Llewellyn, Swansea City fan.
Hi, I'm Dan from the website 1878.net, and I'm here to talk about West Bromwich Albion.
Hi, I'm also Dan, and I'm here to talk about Arsenal.
Awesome. Thanks so much for joining us, guys. Up front, I want to talk about something that I kept hearing during the broadcast of the Burnley-Everton match today, where they kept referring to Burnley as spoilers, which, considering they've already gotten results against Chelsea, Tottenham, Liverpool, and Everton, I mean, I suppose it's technically true, but I'm curious as to at what point, like how many more teams do they have to beat before we just start considering them to be good in their own right and not good by comparison to the teams they're facing. Jamie, seems appropriate to start with you as the resident Burnley fan. What do you think about that narrative?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm completely objective about this. So, I mean, it can be frustrating. I think the thing for me as a supporter of a smaller club is that whenever you achieve something against one of the bigger boys, it always has to be seen through this sort of prism of they either did something wrong or you only did it by playing in a sort of reductive style. You're not allowed to beat one of the big teams by just playing better football than them. That's not something that the media seems to be able to accept. Other football fans don't seem to get it. It's always Burnley have kicked people off the park and they just do it by kicking long balls all game. And it's just not the case. I mean, anyone who watched that game today, it was pretty obvious that the game plan was to sit back, soak up the Everton pressure, let them shoot from distance. It's a game plan that's worked time and time again. Just let them play in front of us and then pick them off on the break. And that's exactly what we did. We scored an absolutely fantastic goal. And anyone who's watched us this season knows that that's how we play. It's not spoiling. It's our own style. And wouldn't it be boring if everyone played in the same way anyway? There has to be some variation. That's part of what makes the Premier League such an exciting division to watch. I mean, if everyone just wants to do pretty little passing all the time, it would get very boring very quickly, I think.
Yeah, I can't disagree with that, to be honest with you. I think if you look at it, you'll watch, I don't know, I'll use Match of the Day as an example quite a lot, but I think you have to because it's the main football show for us here in Britain in regard to the Premier League, and they will constantly hammer the opposition. I mean, I've had it as a Baggies fan, and you'll have had it as a Burnley fan. If you get to Man United and get a result and you've actually played well and you've done the right things, you will never be, it's basically you'll get a comment at the end of after they've hammered Man United and gone on about how they've played so badly, say, oh, and West Brom did well, didn't they? And it's just so frustrating. And I think a lot of it just comes down to just a lack of motivation to research into too much detail about the teams that don't really matter to Sky or to BT Sport. Because, I mean, you look at the running order for Match of the Day last night and it was a 1-0 Man City win on first. And it was a bit of a dull game, to be honest. Man City played well, they did all right, but it wasn't exactly full of talking points or full of any exciting challenges or full of, it just wasn't that much of a great game to be watching. But it just seems that the people at the top trying to sell this Premier League product have got to label certain teams as just those kinds of, yeah, like spoilers. But that there is a lot more to it than that. And I just think it's just the era that we live in, the constantly media driven and the big boys mentality that only the top clubs mean anything to anyone, and it's just unfortunate that's how it is, and it is refreshing when someone can come up with an alternative opinion to that, but it rarely happens. You do just get sick of it and almost just prone, just immune to how it is, you know, being a supporter of one of the lower clubs in the Premier League. I wonder what Dan's take on is it being an Arsenal fan?
Well, back to the original question of whether they're good, I think that's all about the definition of the word good. But I mean, if it's in their own right, yeah. Like, Burnley have always been good at what they do. That's Sean Dyche is very good at making sure lots of team or the opposing team take a lot of shots, but make sure none of them are good shots, and then hope to be able to nick them on the counter. That's always been what Burnley do, and it's worked, what is it, one out of two campaigns in the Premier League under Dyche? Yeah, one out of two. If they stay up this year, it'll be two out of three. It's what they do. As far as showing Chelsea City first on Match of the Day, I mean, that makes sense to me. That's what more people want to, like, if it does. I can't
be having that, mate. I really can't. If it was a free thriller between West Brom and Watford, I mean, it was 2-2 anyway.
Yeah, it was 2-2.
And we was almost on second to last. Not that I'm bothered anyway, because I can stay.
Okay, second to last is wrong. You being second to last is wrong, but then being first, I don't have a problem with.
No, but I think the point is that it should be focusing on the game that's been the most exciting for that day. Not just, let's put the top clubs on first because the top clubs have got, basically, the top clubs are more important. Of course, they are to quite a lot of people. You've got more supporters of the top clubs. There's a bigger audience for the top clubs in the Premier League. But there has to be some sort of level playing field and some sort of realisation that the Premier League has got 20 teams in it and not six. And I suppose being a fan of the bigger clubs, I suppose you, Dan, are quite... I'm not seeing it more as...
club perspective, more just from a TV perspective. Like, we need to get the views. That's the point of our show. This is what's going to get them. That's more what I'm looking at it from, not from a club perspective.
Yeah, well, it's just unfortunate.
That's how I'm thinking of it. That's why I think that makes sense. Like, again, you being second to last is stupid, but them being first, I don't really have a problem with.
Yeah, I mean, I think what a baggy stand. I need to differentiate between the dance.
Yeah, this is going to get it. Oh, well.
the separate point about Match of the Day, that programme doesn't have to chase viewers. People are going to watch that anyway. And they don't rely on adverts. So there's no, we need a lot of viewers to get the advertisers interested because it's on a channel that doesn't have adverts. So that sort of doesn't come into it for me. I understand that City were top of the league and they always seem to start with the team that's top of the league no matter what game it does. But I think more generally, the media has to pay more attention to stories down the league. Watford have had a fantastic start to the season. Burnley now have had a fantastic start to the season. You won't see the media talk about these teams because they're small and they're unfashionable. And a lot of people just can't be bothered, like Dan said, to spend time researching what it is that is making these teams successful against the odds. People were talking about Watford as relegation favourites. Mm. And they're flying. They're absolutely flying. The same about Burnley. People saying it would be second season syndrome. It's not. It's not the case.
But if you know your football, you know that Defoe's a very good player. You know that Chris Wood's going to score goals. Matty Leighton's having a great season. You've got a young lad in goal who's just come in that's never played in the Premier League before and he's keeping clean sheets after clean sheets. Yeah, there's lots of elements as to why Burnley are doing well as opposed to just saying that they're spoiling other top
clubs. Absolutely. And people don't go below the surface, do they?
Sorry, not
to cut you off, but you had experience with this in the 0-0 draw against Tottenham, where everybody was talking about what Tottenham did wrong, and they were complaining that Swansea didn't come out to play football. But if you had come out to play football, we probably would have seen a match like what we just did against Huddersfield. So were you equally frustrated that was the narrative surrounding that match?
No, I actually the less people talk about Swansea this season, the happier I am. But I mean, it's definitely true. I mean, we've had in the past when we have had surprise results against the top teams. You know, often when we have beaten the top teams, it has been because we've got a game plan spot on them, and often because we've played better football than them. But it's always more focus on the other team. One of the reasons is that it's you know, they're a big club and people know more about them because they pay more attention to them too. I think there's a general thing about football supporting these days. It's quite fun to analyze why big teams are rubbish. It's quite fun, I think, for people to look at Everton at the moment and say, ha, 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 they spent so much money and they lost to Burnley. Can you believe it? They lost to Burnley. I mean, it's, people just enjoy Burnley. Doing, you know.
It's easier to point out what a team has done badly than it is to point out what they've done well. It's not just easier to do that. It's probably more interesting to watch. I mean, who's going to be asked about a 5-minute package of Burnley's defensive line being really solid, closing down throw-ins really well?
Look, like, they didn't let them do anything.
I'd like to watch that, but nobody else would want to watch that.
I think that's an excellent point. On the flip side, not to fulfill a stereotype that we just bashed for a while, Everton obviously have struggled from the start of the season. Not saying they failed, which is why Burnley won, just to clarify. But things clearly not going well at that club either. Can we just chalk this up to Lukaku? Or is this Koeman's fault? What do you think has gone wrong at Everton this year?
I think Lukaku has to be the starting point, doesn't he? I mean, a lot of people said that he was a bit of a flat-track bully last season. He scored a lot of goals at the end of games that Everton had already won. Scored a lot of goals in games against teams that you'd expect Everton to beat anyway. But the reality is he was still scoring those goals, and the goals still count, no matter the situation, no matter the opposition. And I think if you take a powerful player like Lukaku out of the team, it does have a big impact. One of the problems for me was the recruitment was all wrong. They signed a load of number 10s. Rooney's passed it. He should have gone there last summer or not at all. He's only fit now for MLS, no offence, or China or the Middle East or somewhere. He can't play at this level anymore. He just can't do it. Klassen, I'm unconvinced by. He's going to need time to adapt. And Sigurdsson, similar players, really. Sigurdsson, fantastic at Swansea. I just wonder if he's a player that thrives where he's the centre of attention. It's all about him. The pressure is on him to make things happen, whereas Everton is more of a just a piece in the puzzle. And Koeman, it's just not happening for Koeman. The Everton fans I've spoken to, they're very frustrated with his tactics. His team selection seem very random. Cuco Martino playing at right back in the Premier League just seems very, very odd to me. But defensively, they just seem an absolute shambles. I mean, Michael Keane is having a horrible start to the season. Obviously, I've watched Keane a lot in the last couple of seasons, and he seems to have gone backwards very, very quickly. And Ashley Williams as well, I'm sure Gusto will say he's a good defender, but under Koeman, he's been absolutely terrible. So something is badly wrong at the top of that club. And I think, okay, Lukaku's gone and you talk about net spend and all these stuff, but Koeman has spent a lot of money this summer and Everton have got a lot worse. So I think they're probably going to think about getting rid of him at this point. It's a case of who's out there and who could they get and stuff like that. But you would have expected a lot more from Everton this season. People were talking about them challenging for the top four, and for them to be only just above the relegation zone and losing to the likes of Burnley at home, it's got to be alarm bells.
I think you've got to look at Pickford as well. I think he's cost an awful lot of money for a goalkeeper of his age. And he's had one full season as a first-choice goalkeeper at Sunderland. Now, I'm not at all saying that he's a bad goalkeeper, because I think he's definitely got a bright future ahead of him. But as a goalkeeper, there's automatically a lot more pressure on you, especially when you're joining a big club. You've got a massive fee behind you. You've been installed as the number one without doubt straight away. He's definitely going to have been feeling the pressure. Whereas at Sunderland last season, he was the number one. But he was the number one at a team that was almost expected to get relegated anyway. So you would see him pulling off fine saves every single match, because they were getting battered week in, week out. And so I think the step up for Pickford is going to be a big one. And Everton fans are going to expect a lot from him simply because of the price tag. Whereas I don't think that's fair. And so maybe a more solid backup or a number one for him to be the understudy to for a couple of years would have been the safer bet for them. Because imagine being a defence in front of a shaky keeper, and it's the start of a whole new chapter for him, and he's got to get it right. You know, you constantly be doubting yourself. And so I'm not at all saying Pickford's at fault entirely, but he's definitely going to share some of the blame. And coming back to Lukaku, I mean, we had him for a season at the Albion. And I think at the time, people were drawing a lot of comparisons with him and Benteke, being as they were both Belgian, and he was at the Villa and Lukaku was at the Baggy, so both at West Midlands based clubs. And I knew for a fact that the careers of both of them would be massively different. Lukaku is a class above. He has got so much more to his game than people realise. And he will bag 30 goals in all competitions for Man United this season. And I've got absolutely no doubts that Everton's fall off is, not entirely, but a massive proportion due to the fact that they've replaced him with Wayne Rooney, who probably hasn't got the eye for goal that he used to have. He has to come deeper to get the ball to create things because he feels the need that. I just feel that as a footballer, Rooney's still got talent, but in a smaller side, more expectation of him. I'm not sure it's going to be a move that really works out for him. And I think it's probably going to be one season at Everton, and then he might well be on his way to one of the countries that Jamie mentioned, China, America, maybe Australia, one of the countries where football isn't played to quite as high a standard.
Lukaku compensated for a lot of Everton's faults last season. They were pretty mediocre without him, and he scored a lot of goals just to keep them in a respectable position. And even though they finished seventh, they were a long way behind the top six. I mean, they were not in the same league as them, really. So when people were talking about, them getting into the top four and spending all this money, they were setting Everton up for a fall. And the truth is, they lost Lukaku, and they were always going to struggle to replace him. And they haven't actually tried to replace him, which I guess is the main problem. They brought in Rooney, which, like we all agree, it was a daft move. They bought a name, not a footballer. Sandro Ramirez isn't clicking there and doesn't really have the ability that Lukaku had, obviously. And on top of that, then they have spent a lot of money on very similar players, and they're trying to get them all into the same team, despite them all playing similar positions. That's making everything clogged up in midfield. And like Jamie said, at the back, they're looking rubbish, absolutely terrible. I mean, Michael Keane still hasn't settled there. Ashley Williams' age is really showing. Every time I see Ashley Williams now, he is making a mistake, which obviously is worrying from a Welsh point of view, but he really is showing his age now. And he probably should not be starting for Everton. I probably play Jagielka ahead of him, which says a heck of a lot, because he started showing his age last season. So yeah, they've just not quite got that complete team. And I don't think Koeman's the best person to have there managing them, because like we said, he didn't really do an amazing job last season. And he doesn't seem to be getting them gelling this time round. So if I was an Everton fan, I'd be pretty annoyed at the moment. And I think maybe Koeman in a while may feel genuine pressure on him, because no way are Everton going to spend all this money without having some expectation of at least improvement on last season. And at the moment, they're so far behind where they'd expect to be that you'd have to worry for Koeman's job.
Yeah, I'm not sure Everton did anything like actively right the entire summer. Like, Keane and Pickford were fine. They were overpays, but they were fine. They were addressing like very big needs because, Joel Robles is terrible and Jagielka is a statue at this point. Not a statue, a mummy, whatever. He's not alive. Rooney was always more likely to fail than succeed. Like, come on, he's been done for years. That was a move made purely on nostalgia and not on actual footballing thought. Like, Episode 4 was not good, but fine. Like, it was fine. And then they went and spent $40 million on Sigurdsson, which was just idiotic. He's 28, I think. He's late 20s, and a ridiculously high proportion of his chances created last season came from set pieces, which is fine and all. Having good set piece taker is important. But if you're spending $40 million on a number 10, you really don't want, like, I think it was... It was something like 40% of his chances came from set pieces. I do not quote me on that exact number. I don't remember what it was exactly, but it was a very abnormally high proportion. And just, he's good. I like him. He's not worth $40 million, and he's not a player you want to build a team around. And then from a tactical point of view, a lot of, I will say the one saving grace for Everton is they've had a very, very, very difficult schedule to start the season. I think they played Spurs.
Yes, Burnley.
Silver linings, man. Silver linings. I am scraping here. Yeah. But they have had a very difficult start to the season, and Koeman's plan against big teams has always been sit back, counter of pace, but then he went and bought no players with pace, and they are extremely slow. So those games were never going to work. They're not great. I still want to see him against a few more quote-unquote lesser teams until I totally freak out, but yeah, no, they're not good. If the idea that they were going to challenge for top six was extremely funny, the idea that they had a good summer may have been funnier. And they're both widely held beliefs, which is hilarious. It's, if you were picking like a most banterful team preseason, Everton were the obvious choice because they were set up to fail by everyone.
I do agree with your assessment that their summer was strange, because bringing in Rooney felt like a move counter to the rest of the moves they were making, as did the Sigurdsson move, to be fair, where it wasn't clear if they were trying to buy young players to develop or if they were trying to buy older players to be good now. And I think we're seeing
the young quote-unquote players they bought were not old, but they weren't like 20.
No, they did 20, buy some 30. Young ones like Vlasic.
But yeah, they were younger. So then,
pretty interesting. But I don't think he was supposed to matter yet. Omar Niasse randomly being relied upon is
Vlasic is the
that might actually be the best icing on the cake ever. The guy they bought like 2 years ago and didn't even give a suit is now their starting striker.
Yeah. Vlasic is the only wide player that they signed, though. Mm-hmm. To come back to the tactics, if you're gonna play with a player like Rooney, whose pace has gone, he's not mobile anymore. Mm-hmm. You need pace in wide areas. And they've been playing games where they've had Klaassen, Sigurdsson, Rooney, all wanting to play really as number 10s.
Yeah.
And none of them have got any pace. So Everton become really easy to play against. You just sit deep. Everything's in front of you. No one's going in behind. There's no movement. There's no incision.
Yeah.
And with the result, they just don't create clear chances. They had 23 shots against us today. We had 5. We created by far the better chances because we move the ball at pace. We get in behind teams. We cause them problems. Mm-hmm. And all of Everton's opportunities pretty much were from 30 yards just because they'd run out of ideas.
Yeah. And actually, Gitto, I'd like to come back to you on this because we've been talking about Sigurdsson a fair bit, and you played him on the left at times. It's Swansea, Everton now doing that because they don't have anybody to play over there except Kevin Morales, who randomly is in and out of that side constantly. Is there a way to get around this issue, or do you think Sigurdsson being played on the wing can be a detriment when it comes to the pace?
You've got to play him through the middle. If you're going to get anything near £40 million worth, you've got to play him through the middle. That is his position. That's where you can control play, and that's where you're going to get the best out of him. Playing him out the wing, yeah, he can do a job there, but you're really wasting a lot of talent there. And the fact that he's been played out wide most of the season just to accommodate Wayne Rooney is just ridiculous. It shows a real weakness on Koeman's part. It's just stupidity. And you can see that as a result, Sigurdsson just hasn't settled there at all. I mean, he's not looking comfortable. His set piece delivery is not what you'd expect from him, which, you know, is the very least that you would expect from considering you're buying Gylfi Sigurdsson. He's a fantastic player, and it's certainly not too late for them to get the best out of him. But if they are going to get the best out of him, they have to stick him in the middle and keep him in the middle. But again, like we've said, it's part of this random policy there in the summer where they bought a lot of players to play in the middle of the park, no real wingers. Somebody has to play in those positions who's not really suited to playing there. And it ends up being Guelfi because he's the kind of player who won't put up too much of a fight if you tell him to play wherever, you know, even if it doesn't make sense, he'll just do it.
Yeah, there were some shouts there for Komen being on a hot seat, potentially to leave soon. Is that a direction that we think we could go? I mean, this is a manager that, if we're saying a lot of this is down to Lukaku's departure, there were still shouts this summer for Komen to take over at Barcelona. Now he's
mainly
struggling.
Mainly from Koeman, to be fair. I
mean, that's true. And
he
the Dutch
pitched,
media,
he did do a lot
who
of
were
that.
Kind of backing
he
him
pitched
up a little bit.
So brazenly for that job.
Yeah.
Like, I think if you did that in a normal job, your current employers would just get rid of you. Because he's so naked the way he went about it, talking about the Barcelona job.
Well, it happened
it's
to
like,
Redknapp,
mate, you've had
at Tottenham, where he was so publicly flirting for the England job that we ended up having to get rid of him.
Yeah, I mean, like, Koeman's, he'd had one okay season at Everton and a good season at Southampton, and the guy thinks he can be managing Barcelona. It's an absolute joke. It's so ridiculous.
I'm pretty sure I've been on the Komen isn't that good train for a while, so just going to say that.
Fair enough. But how long do we think he's in his job? By Christmas? By end of season?
I think lose the next game. I think
it's at Brighton, if memory serves.
They're at Brighton in the next game, and then I think they've got Arsenal and Chelsea, or Arsenal and City. They've got Brighton away.
They should keep him for Arsenal. He always does well against us.
But if they lose at Brighton, I think Dan's right. I think he's in real trouble if they lose that game.
Yeah, well, here's a question. If you're thinking about sacking him, if he doesn't win against Brighton, wouldn't now actually be the best time to do it from a calendar perspective? Because you have the 2 weeks to get ready for the next match against Brighton, which, again, quote-unquote, should be winnable.
Sort of. I mean, I think going back to Palace and De Boer, I think the timing of that was strange in a way because Hodgson then came in and he's got that horrible run of games to start with. And you just thought, well, it's not going to get better. Now it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. So why hand somebody that? It's going to be two heavy defeats probably straight up. So I don't know. I think it's going to be a very uncomfortable international break for Koeman. I think there will be discussions. Everton aren't known for getting rid of managers harshly or early. They tend to give people too long rather than not long enough. But I think it depends on the new guy. Is it Moshiri who spent all the money? He's going to want to see a return on that investment, and the team is horrible to watch. There's not any sort of discernible signs of progress in the opening weeks of the season. And Carlo Ancelotti got the sack this week. He's managed in the Premier League before. I think he likes managing in the Premier League. They should put that call in, at the very least. It would be ambitious, but...
If Everton get Ancelotti, Coleman should be flung out of Everton with a catapult.
And he's going to land softly in the resting arms of the Dutch national team.
Yes, he will.
Unfortunately for you, Kev.
it's not a good time. We'll see where that stands 2 weeks from now.
Yeah, you may want to like just get rid of your eyes now.
Not optimistic, but you know, it's probably better than what we got. We're going to take a quick break and then come back with topics for each of our guests.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
All right, and we are back. We're going to lead in with Jamie, just like we did at the top of the show. You know, we've talked a lot about the departure of Michael Keane and whether or not it was a failure not replacing him. But you had mentioned maybe 18 months ago and ever since that the idea of bringing in, I think it was Tarkowski, was to be the long-term replacement for Michael Keane. Still surprising you didn't add any center back for depth. But in all those conversations, we never stopped and talked about how good he was or the partnership with me and the kind of the defensive setup that allows for success and kind of a reduced amount of pressure on them. How good are they?
They're very good. I think there's a stat doing the rounds after the game today. They've made 30 blocks between them, I think it is. Ooh. Which is more than 16 out of the 19 teams combined in the Premier League. And that's just two players, which sort of, it's an indication of the way that we play and the way that the defenders go about their business. But I think you're right in that it's, the setup as well, it's sort of made it easier for Tarkowski to come in, I think, because he's seen the way we play. It's very much defend almost in an old-fashioned way. You don't see a lot of teams defending the way that Burnley do these days. I think teaching defending has almost gone out of fashion now. You see Liverpool, the way they defend, and it doesn't look like they work on it at all.
I assume you put air quotes around that as you said it.
Yeah, exactly. And it just seems to me that defending's it's out of fashion, and managers seem to have forgotten that you need to drill these things. I think managers like Dyche and Tony Pulis and people like that who spend hours every week on the training ground making sure that it's drilled firmly into the players that you need to be in this position when this is happening, so that it's all automatic. They don't have to think about it during the game. I just don't think teams really do that anymore. As for Tarkowski himself, it's been difficult to say how good he was because he's only really played in cup games and then in massively changed lineups where sometimes he's been the most senior player and he's barely played for us. So there was a lot of hope that he was going to be good, but he's been so much better than anyone could have expected, or even like if you were dreaming in the summer thinking Keane's going to go, Tarkowski's going to come in, it's going to be like this. You couldn't have dreamt that he would be as good as he's been. I think he's been man of the match two out of the last three games or something. And in terms of pure defending, he's maybe better than Keane. Keane's distribution and his skill on the ball and his goal scoring as well, better than Tarkowski in a few different areas. But in terms of the basics and blocks and clearances and being in the right place, it just seems to be spot on for what we demand of our defenders. And he's fitting absolutely brilliantly. There's a few question marks over his ability with his feet earlier on. He seemed a bit overconfident trying to play passes that he's not really capable of and asking too much of his teammates at times as well. But that seems to be being knocked out of him by Dyche. So the partnership between Tarkowski and me has been very solid. We've kept couple of clean sheets in the last two games. Nick Pope in goal has been really good considering he's a young goalkeeper playing in the Premier League for the first time. So I think the system being so set in stone from Dyche is a big part of it. But also all credit to James Tarkowski because he's been fantastic the last couple of weeks.
Yeah, coming to you now, Gitto. Last season, earlier in the show, we talked about how a lot of Sigurdsson's chances created came from crosses, came from set pieces, which is not inaccurate. Helped Swansea finish somewhat respectably in chances created last season. Right now, Swansea dead last in chances created, 8 worse than the next closest team. I don't really see a way for that to improve with the players you have at the club. Do you think there's somebody that we're not thinking of that can provide that, or do we have to just to wait till January and hope you can have another great turnaround like you did last season?
I'm scared that it could be that we're reliant on the January transfer window because, like you said, the first 7 games of the season, we've really struggled to create anything at all. I've got the stats here. We've had 11 shots on target in 7 games, and I'll be honest, I'm questioning that figure because I can't remember 11 shots on target. It's been so difficult to watch because you've got a defence which generally is looking quite capable and quite solid, but then you've got a midfield which is full of really the same kind of players, and they're all getting each other's way. Nobody seems to know what they're doing. Everybody's very low on confidence, and then you've got the strikers up front who are not getting any kind of supply. It's not even poor supply. If you watch the West Ham game yesterday, the amount of times because Swansea were actually better than West Ham. That doesn't say anything because West Ham were appallingly bad, absolutely awful. And they gave us a lot of space in midfield. And Tom Carroll and Renato Sanchez, they were running forward. But then when they got into that final third, something just happened. And they would just play these crazy balls. I mean, crosses, they were overhitting these crosses. I can't kick a ball as far as they overhit these crosses. And Wilfred Bony and Tammy Abraham were just stood in the middle wondering, well, how am I meant to get a ball that's 30 yards over my head? They just had no hope whatsoever of scoring with the kind of supply that they were getting. And this is the problem, really. I mean, Tammy Abraham scored 2 goals this season. I think that is a huge credit to him because he's had no help from the rest of the team. The fact that he has scored 2 goals, it says a lot about his talent. And we don't really have those players to do it. We've sold Gylfi and not brought in another number 10. We don't have another playmaker in the entire squad. So we're basically asking players who aren't suited to playing that role to take on that responsibility. The likes of Leroy Fair, who's just not good enough. Renato Sanchez, who's more suited to playing a little bit deeper and is still regaining his confidence anyway. Whoever does play in that role is not helped by the fact that we don't have a single Premier League quality winger in the side. We're amazingly narrow. That's a problem that we share with Everton, really. There's no pace and there's no width in the team to stretch the opposition. And these are problems that can't be addressed with the squad that we've got, unfortunately. And one of the things that dawned on me yesterday is just the fact that we have loaded our squad with so-called versatile players who were clearly brought in with the mindset, okay, they're not the best, but they can cover several positions, so it's okay. We expect Kyle Naughton, who is not really good enough to play in his main position of right-back, to cover at left-back from time to time, which he can't do. We've brought in Sam Clucas, our record signing, which I still find insane. We expect him to cover holding midfield, left back, possibly even as a more attacking player. Again, he's struggling enough as a defensive midfielder. He came on yesterday for around 5 minutes at left back, and he was at fault for the goal because he's not a left back. We expect Jordan Ayew to provide options on the wing and up front. He can play neither, so he's kind of just in this middle ground where he doesn't really do much at all apart from run, which he does very well. Leroy Fair, too, is expected to cover positions which he's not capable of playing. Renato Sanchez now might be asked to cover positions which he's not capable of playing. I hate the term versatile player anyway because it basically means players who are not good enough to nail down a single position.
Like a jack-of-all-trades.
Jack of all trades, master of none. You know, there's a reason why Phil Jones has been playing right back, central midfield and centre back throughout his Man United career. It's because he was never good enough to actually nail down one of those positions. And he's actually not been good enough to play any of the other positions. And that's what we've got at the moment. We've got a team full of jack of all trades, master of none, no specialists in the team who actually know how to play their roles. And it leaves you directionless. It leaves you in a situation where nobody's able to take responsibility. And when you're trying to attack, if you don't have a playmaker, if you don't have wingers, bottom line is you're not going to create chances. You just simply aren't. And I don't think there's another team in the Premier League which is in our situation. Even Crystal Palace, who have not scored a goal after 7 games, have better attacking options than we do, which is terrifying. And it probably suggests that before long, we're going to be round about the same points as Crystal Palace because I can't see really how we're going to turn around our attacking fortunes.
Yeah, Crystal Palace have 30 more chances created than Swansea right now. And you mentioned that you have 11 shots on target, 4 players with the same or more shots on target on their own. So not very uplifting statistics behind what has been a troubling start for Swansea. Dan, of the Arsenal variety, there's always a lot of noise surrounding Arsenal transfers when they come in. Of course, we had the Ozil and Alexis ones that obviously blew everything up. Even Xhaka last season caught a lot of interest. For some reason, the Kolasinac signing this season on a free flew very far under the radar, maybe because it didn't come with a big fee attached. but he's looked very good to my eye thus far. What does he bring to Arsenal that even though he scored today, maybe you weren't seeing from Nacho Monreal?
A wing back with legs. That is the biggest thing. No, he's a very good, he's actually in the Monreal, Monreal mold, where he's a very, very good defender who is, I mean, he's a modern day fullback, so he also has to get forward well, but he can also get forward. A big thing I like about him is his most, I'm not going to say most, because that's probably fact or statistically incorrect, but a lot of his crosses are pullbacks, which is the most effective type of cross, and I really like that about him, and he doesn't do the whole stupid float this 30 feet up in the air and hope someone heads it with about 2 miles per hour of power on it thing. He actually pulls his crosses back. You saw that for the move where Aaron Ramsey nearly scored earlier today. He's had a couple of those. I think he's had at least one that's turned out in a goal, unless that was preseason. But he's good. He's massive, which everyone makes memes out of. He is the tank in every meme ever. But no, he's very good. We got I would think the fact that he was on a free and the fact that he was done in like May, I think. I can't remember when we actually announced him, but we knew we were getting him in April or May. So that also probably had something to do with the fact that there wasn't a whole lot of fanfare for him. But yeah, he's been very good. He did, yeah, and he has legs, which is as much as I love Monreal, and Monreal is fantastic, and you cannot say a bad word about him. He doesn't really have legs anymore, which is why he's playing center back.
Mm. Yeah, I just thought it was interesting because obviously everybody was tripping all over themselves to compliment Mendy, who I don't want to speak ill about, you know, because of the injury, and I don't want to, you know, take pot shots about that or anything, but it was just very surprising to me that I think they were playing fairly similarly for their respective sides, and one of them was being hyped so highly, and the other was just largely being ignored.
If you want an explanation, I would go with Fee. Mendy is on Monaco, which is trendy, and Mendy is a bit more attacking.
True. But I wouldn't say any more effective. We can get into that if Richard's on sometime soon. The other big news is that Ozil should be coming back soon. Oh, and Giroud got his 100th goal, but I don't want to dwell on that.
It was such a terrible 100th goal. I'm so disappointed. It was a penalty against Bate that he didn't even win. It was such a letdown.
Well, kind of
this
like
is after Theo Walcott. No, this is after Theo Walcott got his 100th goal against Sutton last year. So it's just all about letdowns on 100 goals.
So it would seem. Ozil on his way back, though. But the Arsenal attack seems like it's just started getting going. Does he just automatically get his spot back? And if so, who suffers because of it?
Oh, Wobi.
Yeah.
Sorry, Alex.
Fair enough. When do you think that'll happen? Because Ozil allegedly has been fit for like 2 weeks now.
God knows. I don't know. I mean, he did play against West Brom. He came off the bench. But I don't know. I guess I think he's been dealing with inflammation. Mm. So that is liable to flare back up. So I'm assuming that's what happened.
Swollen or not, day
I
of.
I think so. I can't actually recall if he got called up for Germany or not. I'm hoping not, but I can't remember. Hopefully he doesn't play for them and just rests it up and is fine when we get back, because he's Mesut Ozil and he's really good at football. Mm. And as much as I like Iwobi, and Welbeck actually was playing as one of those two men in behind the striker a lot, Mesut Ozil's Mesut Ozil, and he's better than Iwobi, and if we play an attacking front three of Welbeck, Alexis, and Lacazette, then there's no creativity in that. So it's either Iwobi or it's Ozil, and Ozil's better at football. So, you know, play him.
Fair enough.
Isn't it a bit of a coincidence though? Sorry, I'm talking over you, Kev, but there was all the talk about Alexis and his contracts, and no one really talks about Ozil, even though he's in the same situation. It's pretty much accepted that he's going to go at the end of the season, isn't it? You're going to have to learn to play without him at some point. Doesn't it just make sense to do that now?
I'd go if you have him, use him as long as you got him. Like,
but he's also a passenger in some games. Like, if you go away to the big boys, you're playing with 10 men if you're picking him.
Yeah, I disagree with that. Yeah, I just disagree.
Fair enough. I think the evidence from Arsenal's heavy defense.
I mean, if you look at his contributions against the big teams, I don't have it in front of me right now. Again, over the last two or three seasons, it's actually quite good. It's just, you know, when we get beat badly, that he's the one who's focused on, because that's how Mesut Ozil works, I guess. Alexis is the same passenger defensively. He's just more visible when you see it. or when you watch him play. Like, you see him lose the ball, immediately chase it back. But other than that, he really doesn't do anything else defensively either. There's a lot of people you could argue about. Alex Iwobi, his or Ozil's viable replacement, is terrible defensively. So that's not really helpful either. The best argument would be Welbeck, but like I said, he doesn't. If we play a front three of Alexis, Welbeck, and Lacazette, there's no creativity in that team at all. Because as much as I love Ramsey, he's not a creator. His best skill is running in the box late. Frank Lampard, if you want to give him a bigger shout that he deserves. Granit Xhaka is there to pull the strings from deep. He's not going to create for the pitch, so there's a problem either way. You're not going to get a better defensive contribution from another creative player. And I would again go with the fact that Ozil's really not the problem anyway. So yeah,
I see your point, but Sanchez was pretty creative in the back heel that he set Iwobi up with today. I mean, like, I
think Alexis is
say, like, he's not creative in
it's
a little bit reductive.
Alexis is weird. He'll do the whole, I'll have a really annoying game, but I'm Alexis Sanchez and I'm really good at football, so I'll have these one or two moments often. I'd say for the first 60 minutes of today, that was the case. He then had a good like 10, 15 minutes, and then we made the stupid subs and we were bad after that. But he's very creative at times, but oftentimes if you can't like run the attack through him creatively, it's more, he almost has to be forced into it. It's weird. That's not a very good way of explaining it, but he's weird. but he is absolutely creative, and he doesn't get enough credit for his creativity. He wants to be more of a goal scorer, and he doesn't really want to be the one running the attack. It's more,
yeah,
he'll do it when he has
I'm
to.
I'm gonna stop picking on what you say. I feel really mean. Actually, really.
What
like
I'm here this. For? Come on.
I really come like this though. I just think. Arsenal are going to have to play without him, and I don't see Alexis and Ozil working in the same team anymore. So for me, Ozil would be the one I'd leave out just because he doesn't have that dynamism that Sanchez brings to your team.
Interesting. And has the pace, which we've talked about a lot today. It is like a great backup option if your primary mode of attack is not working.
I will say about Alexis, he is the slowest fast guy I've ever seen. He is not as fast as you would think, as he is hyped up to be.
I think
it's
he
weird.
Has plenty of acceleration, but isn't as high top-end speed.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. He's got the immediate first step. After that, it's not very fast, but the first
it's enough
step
to beat an offside trap, and I guess that's the most important thing. All right, moving on from one Dan to another. Obviously, West Brom are viewed by a lot of people as a heavily defensive side. You have a lot of people that are considered good defenders in the team. Tony Pulis, quote-unquote, likes to set up to defend. But over the last two seasons, you've not really picked up that many clean sheets, oftentimes conceding what would be considered sloppy goals. I'm just curious as to how both of those things can be true, where people always assume that West Brom are good at defending, but also the defensive record isn't always as stellar as people may expect.
Well, I'll put a question to you then, Kev. What is the point in Tony Pulis if you do exactly what Albion did yesterday? What is the point in Tony Pulis? Because he brings no excitement to the game. He sets up to defend anyway. You've often left with a lone striker who's just chasing off the scraps. And he's been, I mean, Rondon's a very good player, but he's getting absolutely hammered for it. And he's a good player. He's a good player. I would back Rondon to score 15, 20 goals a season in a good team. You know, I cannot see a way forward for West Bromwich Albion with Tony Pulis at the helm. And I don't want to sound, because there will be people listening to this thinking, oh, you know, he's been spoiled. You know, West Brom are doing okay. Pulis sets up to defend. It can't be that bad. You finish mid-table every season. It's fine. And yet, it's an opinion that I can empathise with. I understand what you're saying. I probably used to say something similar when Stoke fans were hammering Tony Pulis. But when you've got him as a head coach at your football club, you go into matches knowing that you're going to be set up defensively. You go into matches knowing that you're going to struggle to get more than 35% possession. And there's this whole like debate around possession as well. Like, oh, it's not everything. It's not that important. Yes, it is important, or else Pep Guardiola wouldn't play with Man City how he does. It's important to the point that, yeah, we don't expect to be going to away to Arsenal or away to Chelsea or away to Man United and setting up to go and take the game to them, because that would be stupid for players of our ability. But the players we have got the ability now within our squad to be taking the game to Watford at home, to going to Burnley and taking the game to them, or trying to take the game to them, or going to Palace and doing the same, or even like if you've got Everton at home, I don't think there's any reason to be setting up defensively. And it is just every single time we're playing a game of football, it is exactly the same approach. We've got Krikoviak, who's a fantastic passer of the ball. He can see the whole pitch in front of him. He can create chances for the others. He can get up and down the pitch. He's a very good footballer. And he's been asked to almost play like Clelio Jakob has done for us in the past. There is just no way of getting through Tony Pulis's defensive, massively, overly, stupidly defensive setup every single week.
It isn't even preventing goals now.
It isn't, and that's the point. And I think there's just no atmosphere at the ground anymore because there's just nothing to get excited about. When you're giving up possession and humping it forward to Rondon, he's not winning the ball, and the whole team as a group is then standing, running back 10 or 15 yards to then invite the pressure on them. Can you imagine what that's like every single week? You're paying 40 quid a ticket to watch that every week. It is absolutely demoralising. There's a lot of fans who just aren't going anymore. I'd give up my season ticket this season for various reasons. But one of them has been that if it was exciting and we were willing to do something week in, week out, I might have been able to have found the £400 to go and watch it every single week. But to be honest, there's no reason for me to do that. And I just feel like we've come to the end of the road. Pulis did a job for us a couple of years back and he kept us up. And he's had excuses to fall back on as well since then. He's had the excuse that it's not entirely his own team, or that we've been going through an ownership change and there's been lots of background activity that's been affecting how he does things. But all of that has gone and we're settled now. We're settled with the new owners. They've been here over a year. We're also very settled in terms of the players that he's brought in. We've got a squad now that is capable of playing good football. I'm not saying that we're as good as the top teams, and I'm not saying we're better than all the other teams around us. I'm just saying we've got a squad that's plenty good enough to at least compete with teams and beat teams maybe 2 or 3 goals every week. But then we might lose occasionally because we've, you know, been caught out at the back, whatever. But it's tough to watch that we're setting up defensively and still not being able to see the game out like we did yesterday. I mean, I am on a bit of a rant now, but I may as well carry on. Ben Foster's wasting time for the whole of the second half when we've got a 1-goal advantage at home to Watford. Ben Foster's been told to actively waste time. And then Pulis's excuse at the end of the game was that the referee played too many minutes over. That's no excuse. That's no excuse when your players are actively being told to waste time for 45 minutes. You can't then moan at the referee for playing what he feels is an adequate amount of time added on. Absolutely ridiculous. Yeah. Pulis has got something to blame every week. Against Arsenal, he's blaming the penalty that wasn't given. But he won't then say that to be honest, we weren't just good enough to beat Arsenal. He wouldn't say that. I haven't got any patience at all for the Pulis regime anymore, and it's just infuriating as a fan. And I do get that. Yes, he might well lead us to safety, but he's boring fans to death in doing so. And there's a lot of fans just simply aren't going to games anymore because of it. And as a fan who has to watch it every single week, it's okay to the point where if we're going to snatch 1-0 wins, that's fine. It'll keep us safe for another season where we can do that again and snatch 1-0 wins again. And then the season after that, after we've secured safety again, we've snatching 1-0 wins and being defensively great. What, we're going to keep Pulis and do what? Keep doing the same thing over and over and over. I mean, we've been a Premier League club now for 7 or 8 years. And for us to be playing this negatively, it's embarrassing at times. Just constantly standing yards off players that aren't really much better than what we've got. I hope that sums up how I feel.
It does indeed. That is it for us for time, though, today. So if you'd like to tell anybody where they can find you or any projects you're working on, now would be a good time.
Yeah, I've been Jamie Smith. I cover Burnley for various places, and you can follow me on Twitter at Jamie Smith, which is my name.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. You can follow me personally on Twitter at Gitter Llewellyn. You can also listen to the Jackcast podcast, where we discuss all things Swansea City. There should be a new one up this week. You can find that on Twitter at the Jackcast.
Cheers for having me on. I've been Dan from 1878.net. You can check me out on Twitter at thewatts22, or you can check out my website's Twitter account at 1878_WBA. Cheers for listening.
And I'm Dan. You can follow me on Twitter at @the_jersey_fits, which is only part of my name. Thanks for listening.
And I'm your host, Kevin DeVries, at Kevroff on Twitter. You can find all my fantasy stuff at goal.com and also the FPL Roundtable, which is hosted on this very channel. Thank you guys so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure as always, and we hope you keep listening.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.